People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. And there's a slight difference to this week in a sense that my guest is someone who is usually supplying me with guests to the program and who has access to the great names, the great producers, great directors. And I'm talking about Alison Foate. Alison Foate calls herself Diva Cape Town. And there are all sorts of things. She is, and I say here, her work hustle is theatre PR, travel and lifestyle, writing, and apparently quite soon, tour guiding. That, Alison, is quite an array. Who could wish for anything more than a life like yours? And it seems as though you have a wonderfully glamorous life. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a delight to be here.
And how does it feel to be on that side of the microphone? I know you often are on other radio stations, but as I say, you've brought so many people here for People of Note that I just thought, I want to find out more about you.
Well, it's actually quite unique because although, as you say, I have been on other radio stations, I've never personally been interviewed about what I do, not since I was a professional ballerina all those eons ago. So it's actually quite fabulous. I feel quite important.
So you should be. It's terrifying to be interviewed, by the way. I should like to warn you now, in case you want to leave, because we can leave now and I'll get someone else.
And go and drink champagne.
Yes. But I wanted to just say, since you introduced that, you are a former principal dancer with KPAB, as it was then, PACT, Manhattan Ballet in New York, no less, and you've danced the lead roles in 6 Balanchine ballets, Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, Full Length, La Bayadere, Veronica Papers, Merry Widow. It was clearly quite a career, and I'm told, with some authority, that you were extremely good.
Thank you so much. I actually loved it. It was such... To be able to have a job that is your passion and doesn't feel like such is really quite a privilege. I started, obviously, when I was really 5 years old.
Oh, really young.
Very right young, and went through until I was age 17, and David Poole, who was the director of the day, took myself and Janet Lind up into the ballet company. I think at the time, I was the youngest ever to join the KPAB ballet company. And I started off lurking in the corps de ballet until Phyllis Spiro one day called me out and said, enough of that, very lurking. You need to start pushing yourself forward. And then we were allowed to come in behind the principal dancers and learn and sort of shadow them. It was really a tactic to get noticed. Mm-hmm. And it worked. And every now and again, there were opportunities to step into a role if a lead ballerina, for instance, got injured. It actually happened with me and Elizabeth Trichardt. It was one of the ballets that Veronica had been writing called Concerto for Charlie. Elizabeth, I think she hurt her Achilles tendon, and I had been dancing merrily behind her, just learning for fun, and they were like, you're on. And it was fantastic. It was kind of a break for me, and so it went. And it was a beautiful career.
And then, of course, you made the decision to retire from ballet, that is, at a sensible age, presumably, because it is that sort of job, isn't it? There's a time you just absolutely have to stop.
It is, although I didn't stop. I didn't go to the max that I could have gone. I stopped when I was 27 because my husband had been transferred to Johannesburg, and that's when I joined PACT. And then the business arrangement changed, and he came back to Cape Town, and Dawn Weller, my director up in Joburg, said, you know, stay here, let Paul go back to Cape Town, sort out the move, etc., etc. And I just thought, you know what, I've now done the certain ballets that I wanted to do. Dawn was the one who gave me Sleep Me Beauty and Swan Lake, because I'd always been too tall here because there were no gents to support me here. But in Johannesburg, I don't know what was in the air, but the gents were very tall. And I was able to go on Pearly Points and be the Eiffel Tower, but then there was a chap who was even taller. So it was fantastic, because I got the gap to do all those ballets I'd yearned to do in Cape Town but never could do. Veronica Paper gave me beautiful breaks in Cape Town with Cape Town Ballet, but I wanted those classics. You've got to get the classic under your
belt. Absolutely. That's probably why you go into ballet for the first. You want to be a swan in Swan Lake, or the black swan or whatever. I was going to ask you, now you've answered that question, was it an advantage to be as tall as you are? You are a tall girl, and one assumes, someone once made a joke about ballet, which I thought was quite rude, actually, when they said, why don't they just get taller girls? They're always standing on their toes. Why don't they just get taller girls? But, I mean, as I didn't think of the fact that then you've got to have a tall partner.
Well, if you think about your shoe size, right, yes. And you're going to go up all of that, those inches, and then you are that much looming over a chap. It's a bit awkward, actually. But I think at the beginning in Cape Ab, I was really awkward about my height. It took me a long time to accept that I was tall and that it was going to limit me to certain things. I mean, it's really peculiar to sometimes to see a giant Aurora. She's meant to be 13 or something, and there's this woman, this gargantuan, lovely anyway. Didn't always look so swell. But in, as I say, when you've got the Danso Noble behind you and he's looking superbly tall enough, it just makes sense. So it was not advantageous necessarily in Cape Ab, but then David Poole, always the innovator, the most wonderful director, he got the Balanchine Ballet repertoire in, and it was a huge break for me. I took to it like a duck to water, literally, because it was George Balanchine choreographed on only tall girls. That was his thing. They had to be tall and long and lean, and it was like the best thing. To this day, if I dream about ballet in those days, that is what I want to do. That is what I relive, is the type of movement. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Pact had that repertoire, and the company in New York had the repertoire as well. In fact, we worked with New York City Ballet when I was living in Manhattan because the coach was from City Ballet. So I loved it.
Gosh, you're speaking with such passion. Oh. It almost seems as though you've never left ballet, because clearly it was a thoroughly happy time of your life. You did, as you said, everything you wanted to do.
Yeah, I did.
And the passion is still there. Do you go and watch ballet or involved with ballet here?
I do. I've been involved on and off with the ballet company as Cape Town City Ballet for some time. Elizabeth Tricart hired me, gosh, back in, I think, 2002 or 3 to do marketing. And I worked with Andrew Worth, who was a fantastic PR, really one of the best I've ever worked with. And I was on the marketing side and the fundraiser. So my job was to secure millions in funding, which went quite well at the time. And then left and came back to do the odd season. I recently worked with Tracy Lee when she was executive director in the acting capacity. And that was a wonderful experience. Tracy was fantastic, and she got me in to do Mozart and Salieri and Cinderella, which I loved. And then, of course, they've got other seasons. I'm not working with them at the moment, but that's also because I'm traveling so much.
Yes, and we need to find out all about these things and how you made the transition to PR. Well, your first piece of music I see is, in fact, from the ballet, the Mazurka from Coppelia. Tell me about why you've chosen this, Alison.
Because it was the very first role I did in the lead Mazurka girl in Coppelia back in Der Dot. I did that role, and it's a piece of music I absolutely adore, and I absolutely love that ballet. It was my first proper professional ballet.
favorite excerpt, I think I agree with Alison, from the ballet, the Mazurka from Coppelia by Delibes, and the first choice of my guest on People of Note this week, Alison Fote, who is a PR and works as Diva Cape Town. And you spoke, I mean, what a career you had. I just want to talk a little bit, first of all, before we go into your PR world, about New York. How did you end up dancing in New York?
I think the age of 22 decided I needed to experience work, other companies, other work ethic overseas. And David Poole was quite good about that. He quite liked his dancers, if the opportunity arose, to go and spread their wings and see what life's like on the other side.
So and encouraged them to do that.
He did, actually. Yeah. So with his backing, I started scouting around, and that was all on my own, nothing to do with the ballet company. I just went crazy sending letters, handwritten letters back in those days. And one of the letters that came back was, believe it or not, the Bluebell Girls in Paris. I'm not even joking. I got that audition, which obviously didn't take. But I also got Manhattan Ballet, which was run by an ex-South African living in New York forever, called Charlotte Guin. She's been a judge at the South African International Ballet Competition twice. And I've just known her for the longest time. And she said, come, you know, if you're in New York, I'll audition you. I do have this touring company. So before I got to her, that point, I did loads of auditions. I auditioned for Broadway shows. I got the typical, don't call us, we'll call you. It was really good. I traveled to Pennsylvania. They were like, no, you're great, but you're too tall.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
I had lots of experience in really pounding the pavement looking for work, and then did impromptu audition with Sharla, and she said, great, I've got a gap, and I have a really tall guy who's now a sculptor in Boston, can you believe? And I got the job, and she said the company is going to be doing a short season in New York City. It was at a place called Harkness House, which is the most beautiful building on Lexington Avenue that doubled up as a performance space. And then they hit the road, and we did several states in America. We did Canada, and then across to Hong Kong. And that was another opportunity to work with choreographers like Robert North, learn Martha Graham technique. Again, the Balanchine repertoire came into play, and no classics because it wasn't that sort of company. But interesting choreographers that we got to work with. It was the most brilliant experience. It was short. It was just under a year. And then I came back and jumped straight back into Cape Ballet Don Quixote as the Friends of Kitri with, I think, Linda Lee back in the day.
Gosh.
So, yeah, it was great. I came back quite rejuvenated. I felt that my technique had improved, which was the aim of the game. And off I went and stayed another few years before shifting to Pact.
Now, do you miss ballet?
You know, actually, not really. I think my life is so busy, and I've supplemented quite successfully. It took about 5 years to get that pain out of my system. It really was such a yearning that it used to pain me. But I think now, if I can safely say, I love to watch it. I miss the days before when the ballet company was able to have a lot more coaching, and I miss David Poole's touch. You know, it's a different game altogether right now, but they're on a different path. So there's a season for everything, literally and figuratively. Yeah. So I always go and watch when I can, but miss it not so much.
As someone said, I think it's a biblical thing, to everything its season.
Yes.
Anyway, the season is changing now as we chat, because at 27 you said you left the world of ballet.
I did.
And what made you go into PR, or did you go immediately into PR from ballet, or was there an interim period?
I actually did, in a way, but by default. My husband had started, he's always had clothing shops. He's got various brands like Frank B. Ernest that he had, and Blue Collar, White Collar, and Wild Oscar. And he had just started this particular store, Wild Oscar, and he needed somebody to promote the shirts. So I started gathering magazines and looking in the masthead and just sending information about the store and the product to the fashion magazines. So I cut my teeth in PR, in fashion sector, and then continued to do that, and then thought, that's okay, it's not enough. I'd had my first child. I was, you know, done some at-home time, which was okay to a point, but quite boring. And I thought, I'm going to approach Elizabeth Trichardt about doing some marketing work for her. And that in turn led to me studying at night school through the Benevolent Fund, a whole marketing diploma. And that then became sort of branched into PR. But the game changer was when Hazel Feltman called me at Percy Tucker's recommendation to say, oh, Percy had said I should be the person to do Chicago the musical, the first Chicago. And I was remember walking through the waterfront with my little boy. He was only about two, Oscar, my youngest son, and thinking, that's so weird. I'm on the phone to her and thinking, what am I going to say? She's like, okay, can you do it? And how much do you want? And I was like, can I call you back? And then I went back and I did some homework and I thought, okay, well, I'll just say yes if she calls again. And she did. Promptly when she said she would the next day, she called and she said, yes, are you in or out? And I said, I'm in. And I just hit the ground running.
Because at that stage, you didn't have a company as such. You hadn't even started PR.
I had just an idea in my head. And yes. I remember I started working from a funny old computer, you know, those big box-shaped computers, in my bedroom, in our bedroom, in our home in Sea Point. And I remember cold calling Robin Cohen, who's an arts journalist still, and saying, hi, I'm doing the PR for Chicago the Musical. And I took to it really easily. But I remember Alec Bukas, who used to be our PR for the ballet company all those years. And I remember being on the receiving end of interviews and editorial and going, well, how hard can it be? And I just took to it. And then, so thank you to Percy Tucker, who I have enormous admiration for and gratitude. People like Brian van Reerde, who also encouraged me. Peter Dirk Ace, and you know, one thing led to the other. And once Chicago went so well, I got the calls from David Kramer, Mark Lottring, Nick Rabinowitz. David was actually directing Mark Lottring at the time, so everybody was so interlinked.
Yes, yes.
Which is very lucky for me.
Yeah, and it all started with Percy Tucker, and that's a name to remember, isn't it?
It is great name
with CompuTicket and his theatre. Have you read his book as
I
well?
I have.
Just the Ticket. It's a remarkable sort of history of the arts in this country. Now we need another of your pieces of music, Alison. What have you chosen and why?
Well, I thought we'd do Air on a G String because that takes me back to the most incredible solo that I once did as part of a ballet that Gary Byrne wrote. And Linda Smith had done that back in the day and other greats. And I'd always, as a little girl, watched it and thought, oh, what a dream. And I got to do it and it's really has huge significance for me.
Thank you.
That's The Air, the second movement of the Orchestral Suite No. 3 by Bach, known affectionately as The Air on a G-String. The second choice of my guest on People of Note, here on Fine Music Radio this week, brought to you by Peter Turin Productions, Alison Fote, who is the diva of Diva Cape Town, PR, a ballet dancer, as you've heard. And you got yourself into PR, Alison, through, as you said, people like Percy Tucker and Hazel Feltman and all that. And now, where did it go from there? Because how did you come to work with these big shows and big names, and then you set up Diva Cape Town?
I think, one thing led to the other, and because in Cape Town, some producers and some directors work with various actors. And so, for instance, I did work for David Cramer on a show called Guma, which he was co-producing and writing with Tully Peterson, the late Tully Peterson. And then he was also, David Cramer was working with Mark Lottring as a director on one of Mark's shows. David has directed a few of those. Another man who it's been an enormous privilege to work with, David. And then people would just notice and say, oh, who did your campaign? Because it went well. And of course, one wants retail off the back of a good PR campaign. You want foot traffic to the box office, and you want people to just do the purchasing. So it just went really well. And then, of course, Nick Rabinowitz knows Mark Lottring. And there are all sorts of wonderful people that I've managed to work with. But the biggest, most enjoyable things have always been musicals for me. I love the musicals. And of course, Peter Turin, like Hazel, has just been incredible. So I've had beautiful opportunities through Peter Turin Productions. Oh my gosh, right. I think my very first production with them was Beauty and the Beast, where I first came across the genius talent of Jonathan Rocksmith as Gaston. I mean, one of the best performances that I just can never forget. And then many, many musicals. You know, as I said, Chicago, has been twice, it's coming back now. And Annie, and you name it, Mamma Mia. Whatever's been on the Opera House stage, I've done 10 years' work of that with Peter Turin. So it's been an incredible journey.
But he's had such an extraordinary career and has given so many people opportunities, hasn't he?
Unbelievable. I mean, it's just so wonderful that there are these producers who keep so many actors in work, especially the triple threats. That's not easy, you know, the music, the dancing, the singing, and, you know, and the opportunities that he's given to people like Dwayne and Anton, who now have the Lambda Academy at Theatre on the Bay. So another two chaps that are absolute gems. So I've been very fortunate not only to work on these productions, but to form great relationships with the people behind the scenes, like the resident choreographers, resident directors, musical directors, from Charles Johann Lingenfeld, who is now with the Fugard, to, my goodness.
I bet you the host of them.
The list is endless. Mm. And that's what makes the journey so wonderful for me, is that it's not just about running an editorial campaign and then setting up interviews and going, you're going here, you've got radio, you've got TV, but it's to actually be part of everything, because I like to be involved. I like to sit in on an interview. Like yesterday, I was working with a journalist sitting in on Brett Bailey's Samson, which is coming to Wordfierce in March. And I just look at these people that I get the privilege to work with, and I think, sometimes I remember sitting with David Cramer as well once and pinching myself and going, it's David Cramer, oh my word.
He was with us just a few weeks ago, talking about Lang Arm.
I've just learned as well so much. Mm. It's a multifaceted opportunity for me, you know.
That's a silly question now. Is it a difficult job? Is PR difficult? Because it strikes me, you know, in this business where we are the media, we have these PRs coming to us sort of begging for publicity. Mm. But it doesn't seem as though you have to do that. You seem to have established a rapport with media as well. So people don't dread your arrival or an email from you.
Well, I think it's an excellent question, actually. And I've learned as a PR, and I think this is more old school PR, that you do have to build relationship. The person who you're pitching to, for instance, your good self, I know the kind of people from listening to your program that you like to interview. I know that Peter Dirk Ace, I cannot just pop him over to a random young journalist who might not be au fait with his work, or who might not actually read the press material that gets sent ahead of an interview, and who might not ask the correct questions. So my kind of PR is incredibly strategic. I match the client with the journalist or the radio show host or whoever that might be. and I work very well on timeline, so I know how to roll a campaign out that it's going to come in thick and fast, 2 to 3 weeks before production starts. So Peter Turin, for instance, good example, he'll say to me, okay, we're running our marketing campaign by way of visible billboards and radio commercials and advertorial in the newspaper, and I then know how to time my editorial close to that, so that people are going, oh, hold on, I heard about that on the radio, I saw the poster, there was a fantastic article in that magazine, and it all spearheads together. I think that is a forte of mine, is timeline and strategy.
I didn't even know that, that's how it works.
Well, it
but
does
it must
for
work
many.
Like that, doesn't it?
Well, it should go like that, but the newer PRs, the younger PRs, are all about sending out the generic press release. They're not curating a campaign. I like to tailor-make a campaign. So what I do for David Cramer, or for a production for Peter Turin, or for Brett Bailey and Samson, is they are completely different. There are some central points where you can actually go to the same people again and say, I've got this client for you, would you like to do an interview? But generally speaking, Peter Dirk Ace can write an op-ed for the Cape Times, but David Cromer won't do that necessarily. Or Sylvia Vollenhoven, who just did Krotoa that I worked on. She's brilliant for that sort of thing because she's an academic. So, and I've got people on BBC that have studios here that I know will speak to Peter Dirk Ace because they can take his work and look at the satirical aspect. And it's really, I spend a lot of time thinking about how best to position the editorial that market will go to the box office.
Have you turned down musicals or shows before?
I've turned down plenty of shows purely because I'm not always sure how they'll sell. I know some things are a tougher sell than others. Some markets are, you know, buying into certain productions, and I've learned to gauge the target audience over these last 12 years that I've been doing this, since I've had Diva PR. But I wish more PRs would do that, take that same approach, because it's just intelligent. It really doesn't make sense to, you know, dumb down a top-end, what I call a blue-chip client, and then throw them off to the Daily Voice or something. Yet, having said that, there's a place for the Daily Voice because David Cromer's productions, with the central theme of some of them in the past, that market has gone
ideal.
That is exactly what we want to be seeing. So you have to just test the waters.
This business of knowing your market when you get offered a production is terribly important. And you must have had failures.
I've had the odd horrible experience where I've maybe said something off the record to the journalist and it's backfired. It happened once with a significant client actually, and it was very, very stressful, where the journalist actually got really upset that I wouldn't allow them into a studio to watch a certain client rehearse and mentioned my name in the paper. And that is, for me, the worst thing ever. I am not the person that needs to be mentioned ever. I'm the behind-the-scenes facilitator. It was aux, Rodney Trudgeon, as they say, in the local millennial vernacular. And I almost had a small cardiac arrest.
Oh, shame.
But it was, so one has to be very careful.
Yeah, okay. You know. But with the show sort of collapsing that you thought would work and people just don't go to it,
fortunately not too often, but it has happened that I've had brilliant editorial campaigns and the business has just not come forth.
So
that is debilitating to not only for someone like me, it's a failure, but it's for the actors who are this brilliant cast who have to play to a handful of people every night. Bleak.
Bleak. I love that expression of yours. You introduced me to that expression saying, oh, it's very bleak if things don't work out. Alison Folt, what is your third piece of music? Coldplay, what's that?
I love Coldplay. It's a band, mostly because Chris Martin, the lead singer, is hot. But it's just a great band. It's lovely music. It's contemporary. It's Chris Martin used to be married to Gwyneth Paltrow, and I think it was quite interesting to find out all about that. They had a daughter famously called Apple. We shall not even go there. But I love the sound of Coldplay.
The group Coldplay and a piece called Paradise. Well, I've not heard that before. And it was the choice of Alison Foat, who's with me in the studios of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio this week. Alison is, well, as I said earlier, just to remind you, her work hustle, she says, is theatre PR, travel and lifestyle writing, and soon tour guiding. So it was fascinating, Alison, listening to how you put a campaign together, how you structure it, because I, even in this business, had no idea that happens or that should happen, and very often doesn't happen. And then we feel it here in the media because we get things that are not, you know, you can't really build on them. But how the travel thing seems really to have taken, I'm not taken over, certainly, but it's a big thing now, isn't it?
It is. I basically have, at the moment, two main income streams. Side hustles. So I've got the PR, as you mentioned, and on the other side, I've got travel writing. And that started because in 2008, I think when my kids were a little bit older, I wanted to travel so badly, but one of us had to be at home. So Paul said, look, just go and explore and do things. And I would do these 10-day trips on my own to all sorts of places, from Egypt to, I went all over the place, to Istanbul, and my mother would have a heart attack and go, oh my word, you're going by yourself to all these places. But it was fantastic. I learned a lot. You know, I've just written an article for a magazine actually on solo travel, the reality factor. And I would tell Peter Dirk Ace, who's been my client for, gosh, almost a decade, about these trips, and he used to love it. And he said, oh, you know what? You should start writing about it. And he said, send me the copy that you've written, and if I can smell the coffee coming off the page with something interesting like that, then I'll tell you, I'll give you the thumbs up. I'll never interfere with the copy, never fiddle with anything, but he would say, I'm going to give you the yes or the no to how it reads. And I did that for a while, and I then one day bravely decided to pitch to the Sunday Times about walking with elephants in the north of Thailand at a sanctuary. And they took the story, and since then, I've written intermittently over travel, food, and lifestyle sections for that paper. Great paper to work for because they don't fiddle with the text. You don't want people interfering with the way your layout is done, and things then don't make sense. And they pay quite well. And then I've written for various magazines, the in-flight magazines, etc., etc. I've just gotten a commission to write a piece on Langa for Kalula in-flight magazine, which is great. I've just done a walkabout in Langa, which was fascinating. I think more South Africans, Cape Townians, need to actually know what's in their neighborhood or their surrounding areas. So that's how I got into travel writing. And now it is, as I said, a definite part of my life.
So now do you get commissioned to write? Does a newspaper phone you and say, we'd like you to go here and do this?
I do sometimes get that, but generally speaking, I do the pitch because I'm a freelancer. I'm not in-house anyway, so unfortunately those commissions are quite rare, but those editorial teams know me, and they know that I think it's very key to deliver on deadline, to keep to that. Mm-hmm. And my writing has definitely improved. You know, you're never satisfied with your writing. You always go, oh, when you read it, even a month later, you go, my goodness, what was I thinking? And I do love photography, so I have...
Do you take your own photographs?
All my own photographs. So I have a great camera, and then, of course, the latest iPhone is quite useful because that camera is brilliant. Sometimes one can't quite tell the difference unless you are the expert eye. So I love to do that. I love to immerse myself, and that's where traveling on your own is so wonderful, as you know, because you go into Berlin and you know it so well, but it's nothing finer than just waking up in your own space, wherever you're staying, and you're going, this is what I can do at a whim. You can switch your schedule. You can be very spontaneous, and you can really be in the moment, and it sounds cheesy, but live like a local in a way, because you're hanging out.
You're going to the local shop to buy the milk or the tea.
You're not jumping on a red bus, and although that's not to poo-poo that. There's a place... There's a time and a place for first timers. It's great, but I don't do that. I go back streets and I walk about and get lost, which is critical to actually really getting a great experience half the time. So that is how
Because you hinted just now that you've just written an article on traveling solo. In fact,
yes, I have, and it was for me. It's just been quite the eye opener, looking at the positives and the negatives. You know. People don't ever tell you that when you're in a place on your own, you will wake up and you go, oh my gosh, I'm actually quite lonely today. What am I going to do? And it's hard to deal with those sorts of emotions, how to allay your nerve, stop worrying so much, and what you can do ahead of actually even leaving Cape Town to ease yourself into a new destination. Mm-hmm. Like I always book a walking tour on the first day, or a food tour, or a bicycle tour. And that gives you the lay of the land. You get quite a good idea of where you're at. And, what's close to your hotel, what's not, always works. And then suddenly you feel a little bit more at ease, like the Marais in Paris. I always stay there. Now when I go, I will always go to the Café Charlotte, and I will go and have my eggs, and that's, the eggs and soldiers. Love it. It's like, and then actually now and again, there's a waiter who's been there forever. He goes, bonjour, la même chose. And I'm like, I feel so posh. I feel so French and posh. So, I love to do that because you are part of the community.
Yeah.
Something special.
Do you enjoy the air travel part? Because I know that's what puts me off. I did some boat cruises with Hans van Hokelum of Unique Destinations, those river cruises, which were hugely successful. And everyone said, why did you stop? And I just couldn't do the airports and security checks.
It is a pain, I must be honest, especially with...
But it's something you have to do if you
want
to travel.
You have to suck it up. But I mean, sometimes I travel business, sometimes to review the business class. I just did that now on an airline. But you know what? I just keep thinking of England, so to speak. I think of the bigger picture. And I'm like, oh, that's what's waiting. I've also just done a divine boat trip with a company called Le Boat to the north of Holland, Friesland.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely divine, because all these major destinations are suffering from what they call over-tourism. So this is like under-tourism, where you will start in Amsterdam, for instance, but you know, ease up a little on the city, do it in a day or two, especially if you've been before, and then scoot off somewhere that's less on the radar, not as much.
But that was
your
most recent article, wasn't it?
I
saw just a couple of weeks ago.
It was on this past Sunday in the Sunday Times. So, yeah, it was absolutely divine. And I love floating about and looking at everything from the water side of things, you mm-hmm. know, the windmills and the this and the that. It's really important, I think, to see different destinations, not just what's on everybody's bucket list.
Right.
That's when you are actually then free of gluts of tourists and you really can experience something without a selfie stick up your ear.
Let's have another. I'm intrigued by your next choice, Alison, the Waka Waka 2010 Soccer World Cup song.
I don't know. I've always loved it. I mean, I'm not a big fan of Shakira necessarily, but the fact that Freshly Ground were involved in that, and it was such a great time in the country. So whenever I hear it, I feel very uplifted. And also when I was in Paris with Oscar, it was just after the Soccer World Cup. My younger son, I took him when he was 10. And that we got onto the subway the one day, and somebody had a ghetto blast, and they were pumping out the Waka Waka, and we just loved it. So it's got great memories.
Well, many people would know the Waka Waka 2010 Soccer World Cup song by Shakira, bringing back memories of the Gees, remember, Alison, the Gees.
That's the best way to put it. Yes, I love it.
Alison Foat is my guest. You know, I think I've been mispronouncing your name all along because I called you Foat.
Quite love it. Coming from you, Rodney, I would take anything pronounced like that. It's just lovely.
But it's definitely Foat, as you said, as in coat and boat.
I know, which can be quite tricksy in the Afrikaans context, but let's gloss over that.
Okay, F-O-A-T, Cape Town diva. Lifestyle journalist, content creator, theatre publicist, travel. And now I see, I don't know if you'd want to talk about this, Alison, but you entering the world of tour guiding.
I know, right? So I decided, since I've been writing about Cape Town for the longest time, because obviously I travel overseas, but I do love to explore my hood, as they say,
yes,
and my surrounds in South Africa. People are always saying, oh, tell us what we can do. Why don't you just put a little thing together, a little itinerary? And then I thought, hold on a second, there be money to be made. And I thought I would actually do the course because it's not advisable to run around tour guiding without proper accreditation. I'm a bit of a protocol girl.
But it works, because that's what you said about PR. It's what you said about travel, the preparation, the thought processes, all that stuff.
I don't do anything haphazardly. I'm quite an ordered person from that point of view. So I decided to take up this tour guiding course. It's quite a long one. It's going to take a better part of a year. And it's to be able to tour guide throughout the Western Cape. So the plan is to curate trips for people that are coming in from anywhere in the world. But twos and threes and fours, not many groups bigger than that. And I think women will be my target. You know, higher end things that they might want to take a helicopter flip to a wine farm, do an MCC tasting, or they want to go to the ballet or the opera, they might want to get behind the scenes. So that is where I'm thinking I'm going to be going. It's a long road ahead still. I'll be done probably by in the third quarter of the year.
Okay.
So it's just it's a follow-through from Cape Town Diva, which is a travel blog that I have, which I've had since 2013. Used to be my kind of rehearsal platform for my writing.
That's your blog you were talking about.
Yes, it is.
So how do you find the blog? I'm now all intrigued.
I love blogging. Firstly, it really is 100% my own voice, whereas formal writing for a magazine or newspaper, you have to kind of change that a little bit to suit the type of publication. Mm-hmm. This really can be, I can say words like bleak and orcs in my blog without being hammered by anybody. Grammatical drama.
Is it a silly question for me who's not more up to date with blog? How do you find your blog? Is that an easy thing to do, or do you need some long, complicated address?
No, it's just capetowndiva.com, and that is my actual business card name, and it kind of runs through all my social media handles.
Oh, okay.
But so people can read up about anything from a trip to the Karoo or a stay in McGregor to what's it like in the Marais, 24 hours in Amsterdam. I do keep it tight. Mm-hmm. It's quite visually heavy, so it's more about images and shorter copy, because people that are online tend to want to skim.
Yes.
They're not wanting to be bogged down by a whole saga, that they can get their Kindle and read Tolstoy if they want to.
Tolstoy and a Kindle, my goodness.
See you in 2025.
So your tour guide, that you will be the tour guide, am I right in
yes.
saying? You will actually take these women on helicopter trips or MCC
yes,
tastings
yes.
or whatever.
Shall be moi. Okay. It'll be me. And then obviously if I connect with people, say we are at a wine farm and there happens to be a fantastic winemaker on the premises, and I'll say, well, he'll take over and give a little chat about
how this wine came
about and the ins and the outs of the Shiraz, whatever it might be.
You know what, Alison, it's been a little exhausting listening to, because I've always known you to be hugely energetic and unbelievably efficient. We love working with you here, and so do I, really. And it's sort of, do you take a break, a holiday, or how do you relax? Because you're quite hyperactive, may I say, and what you're doing is big stuff.
I'm busy. I don't know. People often say, how on earth do you pack that into a day? But I find it all it's quite therapeutic, actually. And being freelance, I'm on my laptop. I'm not in a formal office space. Mm-hmm. So I find being in different environments is quite liberating. And I don't suffer much from stress. My energy I've always had since a little girl, since my ballet days. So it works brilliantly for me. And having said what you've said to me about interviewing me, I've loved talking to you. It's an honor for me, Rodney, really.
Come on,
you
Alison.
Are amazing.
Well, it's an honor for you to be here. But now it's all over.
Oh.
But now you've chosen the Rhapsody in Blue to end, and there's a story attached there, apparently.
Yes. Just to be brief on that, I saw Bernstein conduct Rhapsody in Blue at the Met in New York when I was working for the Manhattan
Did
Ballet.
He play the piano as well?
Did.
Or did he just conduct?
He did.
Oh, right.
It was quite something. I went with a photographer who used to live in South Africa called Nan Melville. And it was one of those unforgettable moments of that. And then I did Norman Faber's ballet as the lead in that. He choreographed that ballet for KPAP many years ago. And it's all tied into that memory.
Okay, well, because you've been so interesting, we can't take the whole thing because it's 16 minutes long. But let's try and choose some of the best bits from the middle towards the end. And Alison Foote has been my guest on People of Note. It's been a delight talking to you, Alison. Thanks, and all strength to your arm. And I know we'll see a lot more of you.
Thank you, Rodney.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
Offbeat Broadway is back, this time with an all-new show, Offbeat Broadway 5, Behaving Badly, starring Anton Lating, Lindy Abramovitz and Paul DeToy, directed by Alan Committee. Don't miss this laugh a second show with all the musicals you could never afford to see all in one night. A little naughty, a lot of clever, and a ton of crazy. That's Offbeat Broadway 5 from the 24th of April to the 11th of May. Only at Theatre on the Bay. Book now.